Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your host, Juvon Tai Dung Yi Soon Sin, Jorn Vestai Vampyr, and Jajim Tai Jajim will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Greetings and welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am your one of your hosts, Jajim.
I am Jorn.
And joining us today on the podcast is author, editor, blogger, podcaster, karateka, musician, and all-around hoopy frood, Keith DeCanado, live from New York. Are you with us there, Keith?
I'm here. How you doing?
I'm doing good. So we're going to talk to you today a little bit about a book that you published a few years ago. I don't remember the date.
It was 2014.
2014. So and you and I actually visited about this book at Ozfest the year you were up there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite the deal. I couldn't get your name right. So I finally, I spent all morning this morning saying it over and over again. So I get, so we didn't have to go down that road again.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Jim, it's better that you were trying to get his name right at Ozfest by yourself instead of trying to get his name right at the panel I was on with him at that Ozfest.
Uh-huh.
That's more embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's fine. I'm used to it at this point. I spent the last 50 years correcting people mispronouncing my name. I'm sure I'll spend the next 50 years doing the same. So don't worry about it.
I know that feeling because I keep having to correct people on spelling my name, and it's been 60 some years.
Yeah.
No, what gets me is I am a musician and I have played a few times a little number by Leonard Bernstein called Overture to Candide. So when I see that spelling, I think Candide instead of what it should be.
You and everybody else, so yeah.
So at any rate.
Well, Jim, you've also got another angle on this, too.
Yeah.
You're a teacher, okay?
Yeah.
And a teacher has a license to mispronounce names.
Okay.
As a teacher myself, I disagree with that entirely. I think it's important to get the kids' names right. But
yeah.
It's important, but we can't
mostly because I suffered through years of people screwing my name up. So, yeah.
There you
when
go.
When I teach, I make an effort to make sure I get the kids' names right, and the kids tend to appreciate it. Anyway.
So, we're going to visit about one of my favorite books, The Klingon Art of War, and in Klingon it is called the Kesa, I believe. And you are the translator. according to the cover.
Yes.
Okay. And this book was written by in Klingon by a gentleman named Karatak.
The conceit of the book is that the original text, nobody knows who wrote it. I mean, it's presented as a text that was published in the Klingon Empire shortly after the time of Kalis, with 10 precepts on how to live your life as a proper warrior. One of the things I touched on in the introduction was that the actual authorship of the original is not known. And it's something that the Klingon scholars have speculated about for centuries. This particular edition was released in the late 24th century, and it includes commentary from Karatak. Karatak was a Klingon author who was established way back in The Measure of a Man, which was the Next Generation episode where Data's sentience was argued. In it, at Data's going away party, Worf gave him one of Karatak's novels as a going away present. And so I figured that's the only Klingon novelist we've established. So I figured, you know, why not have him provide modern commentary? And the object there is to expand on the precepts with examples from Klingon history. Oh. And the with the ability to then use other elements of Klingon history that have been established on the TV shows and the movies and so on.
Okay, that's neat. Now, see, that when I looked at that name, Karatak, okay, K-R-A, and I thought, oh-ho, here's Keith playing on his name.
Nope.
Wow.
Nope, that name came from Melinda Snodgrass's script. So
outstanding. Well, maybe she was thinking about you. Nah, we won't go there. Okay, one of one of the great things about this book comes from a line that I pulled out as a quote, and it provides a guide to fighting all of life's battles. And why that's relevant to me is because as I personally read this book, I find that it is not only something that is fictional for Klingons, but it is something that if a person thinks about, you can bring it into your own life and make it relevant and use it as a guide for relationships with people in your own life. Was that something that you intended?
It was something I was hoping for, that it would be something that would be applicable to people in their lives to some extent or other. You know, certainly I would hope that people reading this would not go for the more violent parts of it. But the notion of duty and honor and respect and trying to be the best person you possibly can be, it can still apply. You know, like I said, slightly less of the killing people, but but even so, I was hoping for something that could at least in the abstract apply to somebody's actual life and improving themselves.
Well, you see a bit of that in, I can't remember the author's name, but it's one of the Day of Honor books, the final one, where Kor and Kirk are stop an invasion of a Klingon farming community, and the Klingon farmers are using these ideas, these ways of doing things to fight a crop out of the ground more than just fighting an enemy.
Yeah, that was I remember when that project was being developed, I still am friends with John Ordover, who was the editor at the time, and he was the one who put that together. And he said one of the things he was going for, he wanted to do with that book in particular, and I believe it was Dean Wesley Smith and Christine Catherine Rich who wrote the book, but I don't remember offhand. But the object was that he wanted to show Klingon farmers in that light. His notion was that, of course, farmers would be important in the Empire. Somebody's got to feed these people. And providing food for the Empire is important, and they would treat, you know, attacking the crops, as it were. So yeah.
And it's a way of showing that these precepts can be used by non-warriors in going about their life.
Yes, yes.
Kind of a Dale Carnegie book for Klingons. How to kill friends and influence people. There we go.
Yes.
Now you see why this book needs a evangelical take on it.
Well, it's kind of what it is anyway. I mean, that Klingon spirituality really relates to violence, you know. It's very similar to the philosophy of a lot of Asian martial arts, which is one of the things I was trying to apply to the book. You know, the idea of self-improvement through fighting, through conflict, through you know, that method of improving yourself there was something in the Next Generation episode, Rightful Heir, that really resonated with me. Not so much when I first saw it, back when it first aired 20 odd years ago or whatever, but when I watched it again, when I was doing my rewatch of The Next Generation back in the early 2010s, when Kalis and Gowron fight each other, and for Kalis, or for the clone of Kalis, the object wasn't to win or to lose. The object was to take joy in the battle.
In the doing.
Yeah, yeah. The testing of yourself against a worthy opponent. And that's something that resonated more with me, having gone through several black belt promotions and lots of fighting classes, is that it's a way of challenging yourself and pushing yourself and making yourself stronger, both physically and mentally.
That was kind of the something that I missed from this book, in that a lot of the times you're talking about the combat scenario to improve yourself, you end up with somebody dying. Whereas most martial arts, you can fight someone to improve both of you. Neither one dies. Both of them come out a better person.
Yeah. Yes, because Klingons are significantly more violent. But, which is why it's not 100% applicable in the real world that we live in. Just because, you know, if you kill somebody in a fight now, you'd get arrested. But the basic notion still does apply. You know, the idea of improvement through conflict.
Or, take it a step further, improvement through doing, through action,
right,
through practice.
Mm-hmm.
So are you a third degree black belt now, or third? Okay.
Oh,
you getting ready to go for your fourth?
Like a couple of years. I've had my third stripe for 2 years as of October, I'm not ready for. But fourth degree is a much more intense promotion, and I'm not 100% sure I'm ever going to be ready for that. But we'll see. It's not really my decision. It's up to Chuseki Shion, Paul, who runs my dojo. It's up to him to tell me when he thinks I'm ready, and I trust his judgment on that. But that's not something that I really think about. I mean, I was thrilled when it happened when I went for my third degree, and I was especially grateful that it happened when it did because of the people I wound up going up with. That was as much part of what made it a wonderful experience as anything. But it's not really about, you know, the achievement of rank is nice, and it's useful, and it's also sort of, you know, signals how you've come. And it's also a useful, as I've discovered since I started teaching martial arts, the belt that the person is wearing, yes, it's a way for you to notch off your own accomplishments and see how far you've come, but it's also a useful visual shorthand for the teacher, because they can look at your belt and immediately know what you're supposed to know, which is very handy, especially in a large class. But it's okay. Not really about that. I mean, I was thrilled when I got my black belt, which was 10 years ago now. I turned 40 the year I got my first degree black belt. And if you told me when I turned 30 that 10 years from now I would have a black belt, that would have laughed in your face. It was never anything that was part of my personal worldview. But I did it. I started when I was 35. And, improving myself through physical activity. So just like what we're talking about in the book.
There we go.
Where did the idea for this book come from? Are you with a community of writers that throw ideas together and see what sticks to the wall?
In this particular case, I mean, yes, there are a bunch of us who love throwing ideas at each other, and there have been some stuff that has happened that has come out of discussions with fellow authors. In this particular case, the notion actually started with John Van Sitters at CBS Licensing. He's the one who initially conceived it, and at the time the book was being done, a book packager out in Seattle called Becker and Meyer had a license to do Star Trek stuff. They did a bunch of different things. The Star Trek Atlas that Larry Nemechek did, the Klingon Christmas Carol. There was a How to Speak Klingon audiobook that they did. And I think the Federation the first 150 years was them as well. So John brought that to them. And then they initially actually approached Dayton Ward to do it. Dayton didn't really have time, and Dayton recommended me. So I took it on, and here we are. But the original concept was with John and with Becker and Meyer, and then they turned around and hired me. So
what did you do to flesh out this concept? How did you pick your precepts?
That was a collaboration among Arthur Grossblatt, who was my editor at Becker and Meyer, John and myself. We came up with them together over a whole lot of emails back and forth. I don't remember who came up with the initial list, and then we discussed it and adjusted it from there. But it was a very collaborative process.
Do you take these ideas directly from the series then, or possibly the Klingon Way by Keith? No, not Keith. Mark Okrand.
It was a variety of different things. The thing about anything having to do with Star Trek is there's never really one source for it. We're talking, you know, this is a franchise that has been around since, in some form or other, since 1966, in multiple media, in multiple timelines, in multiple forms. So you're picking, and that's what's cool about it, is there's this whole huge history at this point, stretching from, you know, just in terms of the mainline storyline, stretching from the 22nd to the 24th century, with all this other history that's been established. So there's never only one source a lot of times, particularly for something like this, where you're talking about a philosophical text for an entire empire. You're pulling from all over the place. So it came from, you know, various episodes of the TV shows, various novels that people had written, whether it's going back all the way to John M. Ford's The Final Reflection, all the way up to, the books that I wrote.
I noticed Captain Clagg was in there.
Oh, yeah. I tried to bring in stuff from a bunch of different sources on purpose. That was, I didn't want to just limit myself to the TV shows and the movies. There's a lot of good work that has been done by John M. Ford, by Michael Jan Friedman in his Kalis novel.
There is so much depth if you can bring more things into it, yep, the way you're talking, than if you, yeah, just stick with the TV episodes.
Yeah. The Tiptons did a miniseries called Blood Will Tell for IDW. That factored into it. I use that for inspiration as well. There's just so many different things. And I pulled from other places too. I was pulling, there's some stories that are in there that were inspired by old martial arts stories from Japan and other places. There was no end to it. I was trying to find different stories that would resonate with Klingons in general and with these precepts in particular.
There's no harm in pulling from other genres to bring in decent stories. Look how many times The Seven Samurai have been adapted.
Yes. Yeah.
Everything from samurai to westerns to space opera.
Yep.
So did the Sun Tzu Klingon Art of War, was that anything of a Klingon? No. The Sun Tzu Art of War. Did that play a part in this book at all?
It was actually just on a basic level. That was where I got the idea, because every edition of Sun Tzu's work that you see now has commentary in it, because the actual work is fairly short. And that's where I hit upon the notion of having the modern commentary by Karatak to expand it out. The main difference is, partly because I didn't really want to duplicate Sun Tzu, I was focusing more on philosophy than tactics. There's a lot of stuff in Sun Tzu that's literally about making war, and that wasn't really something that interested me, and I think, or I thought would be interesting to the reader. you know.
Especially trying to bring this to every profession possible.
Yeah.
It would need to be more of a philosophical work
exactly.
than a how to kill the enemy.
Right. And I really don't want to teach people how to kill other people. That's not really something I want to do. So so I was going for something that was more based in philosophy and ways of living your life than actually how to, you know, go out and actually make war.
And actually try to slit
but having said 4,000
throats.
Yeah. There's plenty of that in Sun Tzu anyway, and that certainly was a major influence. And obviously I did read Sun Tzu before which I had read it before, but ages ago, before diving into this.
Okay, but the question is, did you read Sun Tzu in English or in the original Klingon?
Very funny. I read it in English. But
The KLI has put out Klingon Language Institute has put out a version of Sun Tzu in the original Klingon now.
Of course they have. And why shouldn't they? No, I can't. This is my dirty secret. I can't actually read Klingon. People ask me that all the time. It's like, no, I know the email addresses of Mark Okrand and the KLI guys, and that's how I get through this.
But at least you use that. There are too many writers that don't.
Yep. No, I try. In fact, fun story. Not for this book, but another novel I did in my Next Generation novel, A Time for War, A Time for Peace. I needed a name for a bloodletting ritual that would be used to determine that someone bled like a Klingon. And it was something that was going to be used on the clone of Kalis to prove that he was really who he said he was. And so I needed a name for it. So I emailed Dr. Lawrence Shun, who's the KLI, and said, told him what I needed. And he said, fine, I'll get back to you in a week or two. Week or two pass. I've written the rest of the book. I need to turn the book in. I have not heard from Lawrence. I email Lawrence. I say, hey, Lawrence, I need to turn this book in. I need a name for this. And if you don't give me something, I'm just going to make something up. And I knew he would hate that. I would hate that. But I didn't, you know, if he can't give me a term, I can't use it. So it turns out I caused a major kerfluffle within the KLI. Remember, the KLI is made up entirely of academics. These are all professional linguists, people with degrees in linguistics. So,
and not. You've got a lot of amateurs in it, too.
Well, yeah, but the point being that these are either academics or, you know, whether amateur or professional academics, they are still at heart basically, you know, academics. And nobody argues better than academics, especially ones who are also fans, because fans also argue really well, too. So you've got the confluence there. And there was just a major, major back and forth over this. And then so Lawrence finally comes back to me with five different possible terms. Of those five, he said two were the two strongest. And of those two, I picked the one that sounded cooler. But yes, I always try to make use of the actual language that Mark went to all the trouble of creating. One of the things I'm really grateful for on the new shows, on Star Trek Discovery and presumably on the other stuff they do, is that they are actually using Mark's language again. They kind of moved away from that on a lot of the shows.
Not only are they using Mark's language, but the translators who translate the script into Klingon for the actors...
Mm-hmm.
Send them a audio tape of how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
So just as a funny aside, I put the word case A into the translators this morning and got an interesting result. The literal English translation of case A is
really?
Advertisement ?
Okay.
Yes.
It was the guys at Becker and Meyer who gave me that as the translation, and they said they consulted with the KLN because they had worked with them on the How to Speak Klingon audio and the Klingon Christmas Carol. So they went to them directly for a term. So I didn't.
Keith, don't worry about it. Most Klingon translators, at least the ones online, don't know what they're doing. And the KLI will tell
they don't.
You that.
Yeah.
Not only the only time they are really accurate is for very, very common terms.
Which you can look up on KLI.org.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you got it right, Keith.
Good.
So, wow, I wrote down several questions, and you basically just answered them all in as we talk.
Sorry?
Yeah, that's what I like about you. Just ask a question, and you give answers more than we need.
So I guess the question, taking the precepts that you used and that you finished the book, after you finished the book, were there any other stories that you thought about that you wished you could have used?
Not really. I mean, I the closest I would come to that is John Jackson Miller hadn't written his Prey trilogy yet. That would have been something I probably would have made use of, but it didn't exist yet when I wrote the book. Aside from that, not really. I mean, that along those same lines, there's stuff.
That's a thorough writer.
There's stuff that Discovery has established also that would have been useful, you know. That's the only thing, you know, stuff that was created after I wrote it. It would have been nice to have been able to incorporate it. So, yeah, that's really it. Just other stuff that has been established since. But there was nothing specific. I pretty much included everything I wanted to that I thought was relevant. You know, I was trying to have a good mix of stuff we knew about, or at least people similar to situation. I didn't want to just repeat stuff that had already been seen on screen. That's why I very deliberately I wanted to make sure that Kang, Kor, and Koloth were represented in the book, because you know they're three particularly important Klingons. But I didn't
everybody
want to tell
everybody knows them. Everybody's going to be expecting them.
Exactly. But I didn't want to tell stories that we already knew.
That would bore everybody. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I specifically chose for each of them stories that we hadn't heard. In particular with Koloth, I wanted to give a notion as to how, because of all of the three of them, Koloth was the one who was completely different in personality when we saw him in Blood Oath. Kang was basically exactly the same. Kor was different, but in a different in a way that was understandable given how much time had passed.
And the Kor how we much met alcohol had passed.
Well, yeah. I mean, I could totally see the Kor of Erend of Mercy aging into Falstaff, which is more or less what he became. Koloth was 180 degrees from the way he was portrayed. But again, it's been 80 years. People change as they age. And there are lots of reasons why it could have happened. And the story that I had from him is one possible explanation for how his personality changed over the years.
And you'll find that his personality is fairly similar between, what is it, Blood Oath? In DS9, there's a novel, Forged in Fire, where the three of them are trying to go after the albino.
Yes.
And so that Koloth is closer to Blood Oath Koloth than the Trouble with Tribbles Koloth.
Yeah,
because the Trouble with Tribbles Koloth, when you watch that episode and he leaves, he's weak. And he doesn't really seem like a Klingon, you know. However, Kor and Koloth are absolute warriors, and
they're strong.
Kor and Kang.
Yeah.
Koloth kind of gets the short end of the Klingon stick when you get to the end.
My interpretation, also, I don't think he was really in on what was going on either. I always got the impression that Koloth kind of got screwed by Arn Darvin's
chances
there. But that was one of the things I wanted to do with that. And also try to come up with new stories, you know, things that people hadn't heard before, but at least would resonate to some extent or other.
In the book at the end, you have three appendices, and the first one is very interesting. It looks like you brought together, some of the weapons and how they're used and where they've come from and things like that. Where did you get your information for the weaponry?
Okay, well, I didn't do that part. The weapon stuff was done by Dayton Ward. who was the person who was originally approached to do this. Basically, it was a case where we were on a deadline crunch, and Dayton basically stepped in to help out by providing that. And so you'd have to ask Dayton about that.
Darn, that's too big.
Okay.
Because I've always been trying to find an image of a that you got here that you talk about in your Gorkon novels, and I've never seen one in the series.
I'm sorry, you dropped out there for a second. What was it?
The Tricklith, the sword.
A Tricklith is basically just a long sword.
Yeah, but I've never seen an image of it.
We've seen it on the show. That was the name I gave to. It was the sword that Duras used when he fought Worf in Reunion.
Okay.
It was just basically a long sword, but I just gave it the name Tickleth because tick means long. So that's all.
So if you, I hate to say it, but I take it then if you break one of these swords, it's a ticked off.
Oh.
But yeah, no, that particular appendix that was all Dave. So. But I assume he drew on his considerable experience, both writing Klingons and as a former Marine.